Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 348 of the podcast. It's Friday, 17th of November, 2017, as I record this. So today I'm talking with Emmanuel Nataf about publishing in 2027, or at least that was where we started, and we kind of got a bit more short term as it's quite hard to predict 10 years ahead. But Emmanuel is a millennial entrepreneur and also co-founder of Readsy, and we have a fascinating conversation, especially as I am my usual over-enthusiastic self, and Emmanuel is perhaps more realistic. So it was quite funny because I'm like, well, surely you think things are better than that. And he's absolutely great. He also is French, so you will enjoy his accent today. First up as well, a big thank you to everyone who responded after last week's mega show. I know it was an investment, but a lot of you reported aha moments. So I am so pleased it was helpful for so many of you. And you know, I rarely do such long personal shows because, to be honest, they take forever to prepare. And I guess I start having these big thinking times towards the end of the year in preparation for my sort of New Year's moving on. And it seemed to go down well. So I will certainly be doing more when I have significant stuff to share, and also am planning a few in-between episodes. I think that the point where the podcast is with interviews is I'm now scheduled all the way out to June. So 7 months ahead now, which is kind of crazy because the podcast is so popular. Thank you to all the listeners. But it does mean that I haven't kind of left myself any room for my own episodes. So I am thinking of doing those in-between episodes, as Tim Ferriss says. So yes, there may well be some of those when I have other stuff to share. So in publishing this week, nothing really leapt out at me, so I'm going to try and keep this short today. In my personal update, I spent last weekend at Youpreneur Summit in London, run by the very energetic Chris Ducker, author of a new book called Youpreneur. And Chris was on the show a while back talking about VAs and virtual freedom. And the event itself was more about building a business around a personal brand, which I think we do mention in this discussion, but I think is going to become ever more important as the world shifts in some of the ways we talk about today. The speakers included Uber online business and podcasting people Pat Flynn from Smart Passive Income and John Lee Dumas from Entrepreneur on Fire, as well as Janet Murray, who was on the show a while back talking about PR, and Amy Schmittauer, a Schmittastic, talking about video marketing, and a whole load of other speakers. And it was a fantastic event. And what was interesting for me was talking to an audience who are primarily not authors or might be thinking about one nonfiction book that supports their business. But it was so cool to kind of speak on a stage in front of sort of 450 people-ish, I think, who hadn't heard of print on demand. I mean, it was so funny when I mentioned print on demand and then kind of explained it. People are like writing furiously and literally had not heard of some of the stuff I was talking about. And it was really great to get away from the audience of authors where, you know, hopefully most of us know the basics, as I talked about in last week's show. And my knowledge was quite radically new to this audience. So I really enjoyed that. And also, I absolutely enjoyed speaking. And I was trying to reflect on why, because often speaking makes me very tired. And it wasn't the speaking that made me tired this time. It was the noise and light and jumping around. It was quite Tony Robbins-esque, which, you know, for for introverts is a little much. But I really enjoyed the speaking. And I decided it was because when I speak in the author world, I'm kind of known as being one of the more energetic and sort of outgoing speakers, and authors say, I can't believe you're an introvert and stuff like that. But amongst this group of people, I was literally the quietest person around. It was kind of hilarious. There were some other introverts who came up to me later because I did actually say that on stage. But it was so funny because I think I actually brought some quieter energy to the event, and that you know, resonated with people. So I'm really pleased about that. And I, although I've been feeling like I want to speak less within the author sphere, I think I want to speak more outside of the author sphere. So I'm thinking about these types of things because I really enjoyed the professionalism of the event, and the way it was done for the speakers was so pro. I really appreciated it. So yeah, it's awesome. My main takeaways from the actual event were around getting my system sorted. And of course, I talked about that last week, but it's so funny. Again, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm pretty sorted. And then I looked at what some of these other people are doing and I was like, yeah, okay, I see. So I actually got a old school flip chart this week and spent some time with flip chart paper and pens, like back to my old consulting days, drawing the flows through the creative pen and kind of the things that I want to have in place. The website is coming up for 9 years old now. I started the creative pen in December 2008. So I need to revamp some things. I need to redo videos, lots of things I want to do to make it easier for you to find the information you need, because my site is pretty, it's like a behemoth now. But obviously it's quite a big piece of work. It's like if I was designing a business from scratch now, and a lot of Youpreneur was about designing a business from scratch, I'm kind of redesigning, sort of trying to impose a top-down design from a bottom-up, organically grown business. So very interesting. And Jonathan and I are working on that. I would expect to have something ready in January for this. I also met a lot of German entrepreneurs, which was so interesting. A lot of Europeans there. And I'm encouraged enough about Germany and the rise of entrepreneurs and self-publishing in Germany that I want to get back into translation, but only for non-fiction. I really feel that translation for fiction is definitely more special than non-fiction. You know, with fiction, you have to have all kinds of you have to get the tone as well as the story. Whereas with nonfiction, it's a bit easier. And also readers of nonfiction often are not so interested in connecting with the author. So I kind of feel like that I could put out some nonfiction in German, maybe again, Spanish, Italian, and not actually have to build a whole back end for that. So very interested in getting back into that again. And I'll report back on that. But again, something I got into early and backed away from, and I went in with fiction, but I now think, okay, nonfiction is a good place to start. But also because How to Make a Living with Your Writing, which is the one I want to start with, is only 25,000 words. So it won't even be that expensive. Also, The Healthy Writer is back to me the end of today, and I have the weekend to do final edits before going to the proofreader. Then I get also the third Sweet Romance that I'm doing with my mum back next week. So in the next week or two, I'm going to be doing all the finishing energy tasks on those two books. Those of you who... well, anyway, I will contact you if you are quoted in the book and you did the Healthy Writer survey. So lots of things to do to get all of that done. Map of Shadows is now up for pre-order in print as well as ebook. And if you didn't know, you can do that through Ingram Spark. You can put it up with a future date and then you can actually just email their help desk and they will go through to Amazon and ask them to put it on pre-order. So that is available for pre-order. And very excitingly, the cover of Map of Shadows, which so many people have said is awesome, and it really is awesome, thanks to JD Smith Design, the lovely Jane, who's my fantastic cover designer. The cover has been nominated as one of the top fantasy covers of 2017 at Kobo. So I'll be encouraging you to vote for it when it's out on the 1st of December. So yeah, that's exciting. And this is another benefit of pre-orders. Like, some people have been asking me about why do pre-orders, and I'm going to be talking about that more on next week's show when I have the guys from the Bestseller Experiment on. But yeah, certainly pre-orders, you just get more opportunities for merchandising and stuff like this. Like the most of these places, like Kobo, operates like a bookstore. Yeah, an old school bookstore. And there are people looking at covers, looking for things to merchandise. Same at Apple. Okay, so useful stuff. Almost last call for the NaNoWriMo Awesome Bundle, which is at storybundle.com/nano, N-A-N-O. That is available until the end of the month. You can get the Story Structure and Master Outline Workbook, Scrivener Workbook, a Practical Guide to Self-Editing, Time Management by Christine Catherine Rush, which is fantastic. My own How to Make a Living with Your Writing, if you haven't got that yet. The Healthy Professional Writer by Leah Cusser, which I've read as part of my research for The Healthy Writer. And yes, I have talked to Leah about it and I am quoting her in the book. I didn't even know about it until this bundle, but there you go. Hurting Your Characters, Describing Injuries and Pain, Creating Beautiful Books with Vellum, plus Writing as a Team Sport on Collaboration with Kevin J. Anderson. You can get the entire bundle of ebooks for a pay what you like deal, as well as giving a percentage to charity. So give yourself a Thanksgiving present and check it out at storybundle.com/nano, N-A-N-O. And congratulations to everyone finishing their NaNoWriMo books. As I've said before, NaNoWriMo 2009, I did the first 20,000 words of what eventually became Stone of Fire and the beginning of my fiction career. So I am very much a fan of NaNoWriMo. So thanks for all your emails and tweets and comments on last week's episode. There really were so many. I can't read them all. And I really appreciate many of your words. I do feel that because the self-publishing space is so crowded right now, I again need to lift my game to where I can be useful. And I think bringing my 13 years of business experience is going to be a lot of my focus. Also the creative side, because that's where we all can continue learning. So I certainly have more craft things coming, but I think my sort of point of difference, I guess, or my USP, my unique selling point, is that I spent, 13 years in business, and I bring the business side to the indie author world or the author world. I know there's a lot of traditionally published authors listening now, so I hope that that is what I can carry on offering over time. That will at least keep me interested. Okay, so I'm just going to read a couple of the comments. The lovely Monica Bede said, "Your podcast this week blew my mind," which is awesome. Roland Denzel, "Listening while walking to Chipotle, I love this show and appreciate your take on the different terms, thoughts and points of view. You don't ever seem to take what people say as gospel, even when you're legitimately learning from them." Thanks, Roland, and I hope all of you do this. I'm very aware that my point of view is one point of view, and I hope that you take the bits and pieces that are useful for you guys and learn from lots of different people. Oh, and Roland also says, "Indie author or indie publisher both sound better than author publisher." And most readers don't really know what an omnibus is. That's good to get that. Ruth says, "I often listen to you as background thinking when I'm doing computational chemistry at the university here in Tasmania, all the way down the bottom of the globe in Australia." So, and she sent me a picture of her computer screen and I'm like, whoa, that's amazing. So hello, Ruth. Thomas Thanase says, "What an amazing podcast, a broad spectrum of things to think about." What else? Oh, Anna McNuff sent a picture of her running. She says, "I'm running in the buff. Our hosts in Clarenville gave me a new buff, so it was only polite to take it for a run while listening. Exploring Newfoundland's..." I don't know how you say that. I always say Newfoundland, but I think there's a way. Newfoundland, is that the way? I don't know. Network of old railway lines and turn trails. And Anna's saying a buff, and I think it's like a headband. That's certainly what her picture is of, like a nice Canadian headband. Daniel Hurst, "Listening on a jog around Lake Michigan in Chicago." Beautiful place. I've been there several times. Paul Holmes says, "I love the honesty of your shows. None of this namby-pamby crap, just solid facts." Solid facts and some opinions, Paul. Absolutely some opinions. Carolyn Smith, "Love the episode. Would love to see more like this." Pete Blythe says, "I am his spirit animal," which I appreciate. I love that phrase. I think it's awesome. F.R. Jameson says, "It must listen to this week's podcast. It might seem daunting over an hour and a half." But there's so much useful stuff. Thank you, F.R. Jameson. And of course, it was an hour and a half for you guys, but it took me like, I don't know, probably, I think it was about 8 hours preparation for that show, just of preparing all of that. But yeah, it's really good to get it down. And this is another tip about blogging, actually. I was saying to a friend of mine the other day, she was going through a certain experience. And I said, look, it'd be great if you blogged that, not just for the other people in the world, but for you. Because when I look back at, so for example, my first NaNoWriMo, if you go to thecreativepen.com/first novel, you're going to see me in 2009 doing NaNo and not having a clue, like seriously not having a clue. And I leave all that up there because why not? I mean, I didn't used to wear makeup back then and I'm on video. I just didn't care. I was doing stuff using some really basic equipment. I was talking about things that I listen back now and go, oh my goodness, I didn't know a thing. But the point is, by putting this stuff down, over time we look back and we realize how far we've come. And I think that's so important. So I still believe in blogging as a way to document your journey and turn what you consume into producing something. So many more things. Claire Sager says, love the show. I'm going to give it a second listen to really suck out the marrow. Extra mini-sodes would be great in future. And yeah, thank you to everybody. I really appreciate all these comments and tweets. One from Emily Labram, who I had a bit of a Twitter conversation with. This overview and the 5 to 10 year shifts is a useful, fabulously useful must listen for publishers, hybrid and indie authors alike. And it's interesting because Emily was kind of talking about how traditionally published authors might also, and traditional publishers might learn from this type of stuff. So I'm so glad it's useful. I hope today is just as useful. Okay, so today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and some sad news as Mark Lefebvre leaves Kobo to move on to exciting new things. Of course, over the last loads of years, he's done an amazing job of growing Kobo Writing Life, but he's an author. Mark is an author, and it's going to be so interesting to see what he does next. He's embedded in the indie community, so I have no doubt we'll see him at author events just with another hat on. So And people will still recognise his voice from my show. So wishing you all the best with your new endeavours, Mark. So Mark has moved on, but he has handed over Kobo Writing Life to his wonderful team and the awesome Christine Munro, who I met in Canada a few years back. And she's been part of Kobo Writing Life for a long time. She knows what authors need. And she's also an advocate for indie authors. And you will be hearing from Christine in the Kobo ads going forward and also from her team. So this corporate type of sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon and who have been supporting for several years now. Thank you so much to all of you. It means a lot to me. Thanks to a new bumper crop of patrons. And I always know when I've done a show that resonates because I get a new batch of Patreon supporters. So thanks to Mark Saint, and at the handle Mark Saint Thought Lab, Elizabeth Browd, Matt Haggett, Amber Edwards, Anne Tucker, Rachel McCollin, L.E. Wilson, and Rod Kutcher. Thanks to all those new patrons, and I really do appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And on Patreon, you can support me with just a few dollars or a coffee a month or a couple of coffees a month, and you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I just recorded and went out yesterday or the day before. Oh, well, when you get this, it will have been last week. So, and of course, if you begin to support the show, you get all the backlist Q&A and the chance to ask your questions in our private Patreon area. And you can actually listen to those now on your podcast RSS feed. So it's much easier to listen to. So you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Thank you. Here's a word from our sponsor, and then we'll get on with the interview.
Hey Creative Pen listeners, I'm Christine Munro, the Senior Manager of Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free self-publishing platform and a proud longtime sponsor of this podcast. Did you know that you can distribute your ebooks to Overdrive with one click right in your Kobo Writing Life dashboard? you'll get the full 50% royalty on the library price you set, which is exactly what you would receive if you had a direct overdrive account, but without the hassle of managing two accounts. It's the very best royalty rate that you'll see anywhere, and that's because Kobo and Overdrive are sister companies, and we're working together to help library users get the best ebooks from amazing authors like you. We're rolling out Overdrive distribution to all KWL users in the next few months, but if you want access right now, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you all set. We encourage authors to set a library price at 1.5 to 3 times higher than their ebook list price, and you'll get 50% of that price every time a library purchases your book. And then your fans can borrow your ebook for free on Overdrive's new app, Libby. That's L-I-B-B-Y. That's right, you get paid 50%, and library users get to read for free. For more information about setting up a free Kobo Writing Life account, head to kobo.com/writinglife. Thanks so much, and I'll hand it back over to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm here with Emmanuel Nataf. Hi, Emmanuel.
Hey, Joanna. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Emmanuel is the co-founder and CEO of Readzy, a marketplace that connects authors and professional freelancers, as well as a street photographer for fun. He's also a millennial and invested in cryptocurrency. Now, the reason I invited Emmanuel on is it's 10 years since the iPhone and the Kindle came on the market. So today we're looking into the future about what will affect authors in the next 10 years to 2027. And I got talking to Emmanuel over drinks one evening and discovered all this interesting stuff about him. So that's why he's on the show with me today. But before we get into it, just we've obviously had Ricardo on the show talking about what Readzy is. But tell us, where are you from and why did you get into the publishing business as a tech startup?
Cool. Thanks a lot for, you know, having me on this podcast. It's really cool to be here. So where I'm from? So I'm from Paris. I was born and raised in Paris. Studied most of my studies in Paris as well, in France. I actually met Ricardo while we were studying in a business school. Studied a little bit in Toronto as well, so Canada. And I got into publishing because I just love cultural industries. And actually, when I moved to Canada, I was like, okay, I'm not going to bring all these books with me. I'm just going to get a Kindle and get all my books on it. And I thought that was a really interesting experience for me. I didn't read that much actually before getting my Kindle, and it became kind of an enabler for me. Suddenly I would just like load tons of books and read a lot more than I used to. And I started to get into that world. I love cultural industries. As you mentioned, I do a lot of street photography in my spare time. So whenever I'm not working on Readzy, at Readzy, then I just, you know, go out and take pictures of people on the street. I shoot them, but I don't kill them. And I started to learn about that space, and I realized how, like, you know, how amazing self-publishing was, you know, as a concept, essentially, you know, as a business model. The creative freedom that you were getting out of it. And I thought that was really amazing. But at the same time, I was a bit like, okay, this is awesome. You know, you can just, you know, push your book to the Kindle store or any other store and get most of the royalties back. I thought that was amazing. But at the same time, most of the books that were self-published didn't feel that great. So that was just in 2013 or something like that, when I first had the idea. And I was like, how can we make that process better? You know, like there's a lot of people who are just going to create a WordPress blog, and, you know, and suddenly they look like, you know, professional journalists. How do we make that happen for people who want to publish books? So I realized that a lot of people who used to work in-house at publishing companies were available and working as freelancers. Started to interview some of them, trying to get an understanding of what they were looking for, how they would get clients and everything. Interviewed over 100 people, I think. And then progressively felt like, you know, it wasn't that hard maybe to match great professionals with authors who were looking to publish a high quality book. So that's how I got into the space. then it took a little bit of time before I, you know, put a team together, started the company with Ricardo, as you mentioned, who was on the podcast recently. And then, you know, we built an MVP, we raised a bit of money, and then, and now we've helped produce about 3,500 books. So, which is kind of cool.
It is cool. And it is I love Readio. It's fantastic. And, you know, having that vetted professional stuff. So, but let's get into the topic of today, because you talk there as the Kindle as a technical enabler for your reading. And I think that's the positive slant we want to bring today, is that technology as an enabler for things that people have been doing for ages. So, you know, like photography is enabled by Instagram, you know, the Kindle is enabled reading. So I wanted to start with the blockchain, because you and I were talking about that that one evening, and the Alliance of Independent Authors has recently launched Blockchain for Books initiative. Now, it's so interesting, because I've talked to a lot of people my age, I'm 42 and older, and people are like, they're confused about what blockchain is, whether it's the same as Bitcoin, what is cryptocurrency, and why the hell should authors be interested. So let's start with explaining what is blockchain and why is it different to Bitcoin?
Cool. So we started, like, people started to talk about Bitcoin roughly in 2009, because there's that random guy or random group of people on the internet who posted a blog post, a post on a forum and saying, hey, I created Bitcoin. And if you actually Google that, if you just like Google like Satoshi Nakamoto on Google and you try to find like the first blog post, you're going to find it. And it's really funny, because you see like the, you know, the origins of the whole concept, the whole project. And so basically Bitcoin is it's a cryptocurrency. It's basically a token that will allow people to transact and store money, store value in a decentralized fashion. So that's kind of like an interesting open network, so a decentralized network for the financial industry, basically. And blockchain is more a concept, more kind of a, you know, the underlying technology, and Bitcoin is just an application of it. But there's like tons of different cryptocurrencies that exist for different purposes. And the concept behind blockchain is that instead of having a central organization that owns all the information about something, you're going to have an open distributed database ledger that records all transactions in a very efficient way, in an irreversible way as well. So it's called a blockchain because you add, you know, different bits of a chain one after the other. They have a mathematical relationship. So you can verify that, you know, something happened after something else, essentially.
Yeah, and I know everyone's going, okay, I still don't understand that. because I've been reading this over and over again in an attempt to try and understand it. But I think, you know, just taking it up a level for people, it's like the internet. Like, we don't have to understand the internet in order to use the internet, right? I don't need to know how to program.
Totally.
So that's kind of what I'm saying with blockchain. It's like, you don't need to understand the code or the technical side of things, right? It's more like, I guess the question is, do you feel like this is what the internet was, I guess, back in the 80s when you were, I guess, just born or something? But, you know, but it's, you know, at the point where the internet started, it was very technical and only a certain number of people used it. But then it became something that kind of took over. So if we're thinking about how is the blockchain, like by 2027, how do you think the blockchain and cryptocurrencies will affect authors, or will we be using them?
Okay. So I agree with that. So like, unless you want to start investing in that kind of, in that sphere and in cryptocurrencies, you probably don't need to get, you know, to go too much in depth and try to understand really, you know, what's going on. But if you do, you should probably, you know, you should probably do some reading to try to understand what's happening and the technical aspects of it. But essentially we're making cryptography, you know, more mainstream in a way and useful for different purposes. So there's going to be tons of different applications. basically, there isn't a single industry that's not going to be disrupted by blockchain technology. So anything you can think of it's going to change. Right now, we live in a very weird world where, so as you said, like we thought the internet would be a very decentralized, you know, technology. And it turned out, you know, not to be a decentralized, you know, technology. In the end, it's like, you know, a few players controlling the internet. You know, probably everyone who's listening to the show right now has a Facebook account. And like all the information, you know, is processed by Facebook and is sold by Facebook to third parties, basically. So it's very weird. And you look at the consequences, like, you know, the US election potentially, and you're like, well, this is sad. Like, you know, you look at, you know, hundreds of millions of Americans, maybe, who still like ads that, you know, the Russians vote or something like that. And that is possible because you have a centralized entity and it's very easy to then access everyone and just like advertise to everyone. So, and it's really funny that now Facebook is going to hire 10,000 people to remove misinformation by the end of 2018. But Facebook is just one example. You look at, you know, authors. So authors, obviously, they put their book available on the Kindle store or any other store. And, you know, they give 30% of their royalties to Amazon. Well, we could think that in the future, there might be a decentralized Amazon where basically there's no fees, there's no commission. Like maybe there's a tiny, tiny fee for operating transactions and running contracts basically through a platform. That world where you give 30% to Apple, you know, whenever you sell an app, or 30% to Amazon whenever you sell a book or whatever it is, it might disappear. And you can think of applications for that in literally every single industry.
So I think that the key point here is that decentralization. So as you say, you know, right now, pretty much everyone listening is going to use Amazon KDP to sell most of their books to customers around the world. But, you know, I've started selling direct through some things, but PayPal, for example, paying by email in multiple currencies, PayPal kind of owns that space. I mean, there are other things. So do you see that by 2027, we would mostly be doing transactions globally on the blockchain with decentralized payments directly to customers? Or do you see companies like Amazon and PayPal creating applications on the blockchain, so we kind of still use them like that?
I don't know whether Amazon's going to build a blockchain-based Amazon. Maybe. That'd be good for them, actually. But right now, what you're seeing is a lot of organizations that, you know, they're non-profit, essentially. But they're building that infrastructure and those platforms that are going to allow people to transact. So it's never going to be just you. There's always going to be, you know, some kind of platform that people are going to use, and it's going to be the go-to platform to basically make that happen. But it's just that platform, that intermediary, will not charge you 30% every time you sell something. You know, they're gonna create an open source technology that anyone, if they want to, can change and build on top of it their own version of the platform. So it's gonna be really interesting. You can imagine that in the future, instead of having, like, you know, switching back to Facebook again, but like instead of having Zuckerberg like waking up in the morning and saying the future is going to be like this and, you know, policies at Facebook are going to be like that, maybe there's a bunch of developers based wherever in Estonia, or like, I don't know, wherever in Asia, wherever you want on the planet, that are going to think, oh, okay, so that code does that right now. How about we change this bit or that bit? And we're going to build our own version of Facebook, and maybe adoption will take off and more people will use it. So you have like an infinite number of Facebooks basically that could exist in the future. Same for Amazon. But hopefully there will be kind of an interesting platform to make that happen as a, you know, to start with.
No, it's so funny because I've been thinking recently about how I was away somewhere and someone said sci-fi authors have really old websites because they built them first. Like many of them built them back in the day and they, before WordPress, for example. So it's almost like, you know, when you build something now, you've got the benefits of everything. And, you know, Jeff Bezos said, and I think it was 2015, Amazon will be disrupted. And I was thinking, you know, when you build a massive system on a particular technical platform, to actually upgrade that is a lot harder than building something from scratch on a new platform. So you're more likely to see another wave of disruptive technologies.
There's one of the biggest challenges to disrupt Amazon, essentially, is that Amazon doesn't just sell like digital products. If you're selling a digital product to someone, then, you know, it's fairly straightforward. You know when the file has been downloaded, you know when the file has been read, you have lots of information about, you know, how the people used that digital asset that you were selling. If you want to send it's a Readzy book, then you need like a proof that the person who actually bought it received it. So you need, you know, the supply chain, the infrastructure underneath to allow you to verify that someone actually got the book in the end. So disrupting Amazon is like, you know, there's, you know, you can probably you can see very easily how some people are going to disrupt, you know, some aspects of it, like, you know, so Amazon sells, they sell ebook. That feels like something that can be disrupted, not fairly easily, but that feels really doable. Same for any digital product, essentially. Mm. But, you know, Tesla, in a way, they started making their own TV shows and their own movies and everything. So, you know, like, so in the end, you're going to go to Amazon maybe because they have interesting content. So it's so interesting. But for physical products, it's a different story because there's, you know, physical activity that's involved. So go disrupt that. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. And with physical products as well, it's, you know, thinking about a book, actually the technology for printing books won't be disrupted by like 3D printing because that's more for, you know, shapes and things, not for pages with printed text on. So it is quite interesting that older technology will probably remain. So, you know, I appreciate that. The other thing I wanted to ask about on the contract side, which is something the Alliance of Independent Authors are talking about, is that you could do much easier contracts around foreign rights. You could do micropayments. So, for example, you know, I can have a micropayment, you know, whenever one digital book is sold, X percent goes to me, X percent goes to the editor, X percent goes to Readzy if you did the connections. So that micropayments, and, you know, sort of given what's happening in India with micropayments and digital currency, is that a big shift, do you think?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. So as we said earlier, Bitcoin is one application of, you know, the blockchain technology. But a few years ago, there's something else that emerged called Ethereum, which is built on the blockchain, built to create decentralized applications, essentially. So they call them DApps, decentralized applications. And with that, you're able to create smart contracts, which are basically bits of code that developers submit and are executed by a distributed network of computers, essentially. And with that, we should be able to do what you just described. And it's really interesting because, like, it's not a new idea. Like, the idea of having, like, multiple people sharing royalties by the execution of a contract in a completely automated fashion. You know, there was that startup, I think, called Netminds, and there's been quite a few, actually. They're dead now, but it doesn't really matter. That idea that, you know, you could have like contracts that would be automatically executed to pay different artists, different creatives, is not a new idea. But like, certainly we have the technology to make that happen. So yeah, so it's going to be extremely interesting. Micropayments, maybe we're going to pay you, you know, every page you read, we can send you money. Every page that is read, then maybe we can send you money. It's going to be quite interesting. There's going to be new business models, essentially. So that's why, you know, I flipped it around like just a second ago, because in the future, maybe you don't get paid when people read the page, but you people when they, and in the end, you make money off people who don't finish your book. You can pay people to read your book, and all the people who don't finish it, you know, they obviously, you get them, you keep the money, and if they if they do finish it, then you send it back, essentially.
Ah, interesting. Well, and this is the thing, because I think the big shift in cryptocurrency is, even though most of us are using, you know, not real money, I mean, we are not going around doing most of our payments and receipts with actual money, people still get confused about cryptocurrency. It's just the word makes it difficult. And when you talk about payments, people are still thinking like physical transfers and stuff. So I guess, you know, here we should just say to everyone, there is actually nothing that authors can do right now to take advantage of this, is there? It's more like, this is happening, just be aware of it. Like, is there anything else you would advise people?
Yeah, and the reason why it's not, and no one can do anything with it, is that the technologies are not ready for you know, to be used at scale, essentially. So a technology like Bitcoin can process something like 8 transactions a second, when a company like Visa or MasterCard can do like 1,000 transactions a second. So obviously all those technologies, they're going to evolve. They all have roadmaps with, you know, significant changes to the technology, and they're going to test things, and they're going to fail. Essentially, all those technologies are like very early stage companies right now. Things you would invest in when there's like 5 employees. Mm. So things you don't necessarily want to trust, actually, you know, yeah, we'll find out. But yeah, for authors, there is no, right now, they don't have to panic, because, like, you know, there's nothing they can really do with it. They can just think and be inspired.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what we're doing. We're sort of thinking 2027, what are some of the exciting things? And this is exciting, because it can put it can give us more of a percentage of sale. It can give us micropayments, which will enable us to reach these other countries. But let's talk about
There's a website called Steemit, so Steem, Steemit.com. And it's really interesting, because it's kind of a Reddit. It's very similar to Reddit, but it's built on the blockchain, essentially. So there's 3 or 4 different types of currencies, basically. So you can buy Steem dollar, and you can reward people who are actually writing interesting content. And people who curate content are rewarded as well with coins that they can use. And there's different types of coins. It's interesting, there's something called Steem Power that gives you more authority on the platform. And it's super interesting to see that in the past, you go on the platform, you give all your information, you publish high quality content. And in the end, the company that really become successful out of it is the company that created that platform. It's Facebook, it's Google, it's whoever. But you, if you publish like a great post on Facebook, you might get likes. Okay, and if you advertise a product behind it, maybe you'll sell something. But in the end, you're a user of the platform, and you're not really rewarded for being a user. Mm-hmm. In the future, with tokens, the value of your tokens, whatever the currency is, whatever the platform is, the value might increase as the number of people who join that platform increases. So suddenly you're not just a user, and you're just like kind of like an animal that, you know, that big companies use for advertising. You actually have some kind of ownership in the product, and it's very, very different.
Mm. Oh goodness! See, we've got so many other things to cover. So let's move on, because one of the things that is really happening already is the AI and machine learning. So artificial intelligence and machine learning. So, you know, AIs have been writing nonfiction articles and sports journalism and technical journalism for a couple of years now, I think. And recently have started writing not very good fiction, but one AI got into the finals of a Japanese literature competition. And this Halloween, as we talk in 2017, MIT had a horror bot that was putting out horror stuff. And it, you know, what was interesting is somebody emailed me or it was on Twitter or something and said, this is high school quality work, with the assumption that this wasn't very good. And I was like, if this is high school quality work, then this is a very good AI, because, you know, that's pretty amazing if they're already that developed. So, yeah. I mean, I'm looking forward, because in 2027, I fully intend to be using as much AI as possible as like a centaur, like in chess, you know, they have AI centaurs who work with the chess master and beat the AI alone or human alone. So I'm really excited, but many people are very scared. And there's these kind of scary articles like, you will be out of a job, right? Because of AI. Mm. So what are your feelings around AI and how we will work with them?
Yeah, I think one of the best ways of like getting an understanding of what AI can do today is to watch that video. I can probably find the name of it, but it was they had it featured at the Barbican museum in London a few months ago. There was an entire exhibition about sci-fi, and you know, they were talking about the first sci-fi movies and everything. And at the end of the exhibition, there was kind of a short clip, and one of the main actors in that short clip is one of the guys who the main actor in the TV show Silicon Valley, and he was basically like, you know, the script was basically something that had been compiled by AI. And it's really funny because it feels like it makes sense. Like the tone, everything, the story, it feels like, you know, it feels like there's something happening. But the more you listen, the more you realize that it makes no sense. And it's really interesting because it gives you an idea of, you know, what AI can do today. So if you Google it, I'll try to give you the link afterwards.
We'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah. But it's pretty interesting. Gives you a sense of what AI can do today. So should people be scared of AI? AI today is nothing's really scary today. Because essentially, as you just described it, actually, with like, you know, the MIT researchers that, you know, create horror stories based on Reddit posts, hundreds of thousands of Reddit posts. Essentially, they're doing that based on historical data, essentially. And all the AI we have today, it's mostly scripted AI. So it's like you're playing a video game and you have a sense of, you know, like there's characters and they have this script and they're going to move around and it feels like, you know, they're doing their thing, but in fact, it's mostly scripted, essentially. And we're doing that because it allows us to control the outcome. If suddenly, you know, we play a video game or we are in some kind of experience where we can't control the outcome, then you don't know what people should be looking at. You don't know what people should be doing, and you can be worried about the consequences as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe we started doing that kind of like scripted AI simply because it's simpler for us to understand, and also because we didn't really have the technology to do any better. But when you think about it, we built a world where you're gonna have tons of people saying, oh, this is an aubergine and this is not an aubergine. And, you know, and like teaching a machine, you know, what an aubergine looks like and what an aubergine doesn't look like. And it's kind of like the state of the AI right now. Mm. And so we're able to do slightly more sophisticated things. You know, I saw that Udemy, for instance, you know, like the online learning platform, what they do to train for the sales team, instead of having the salesperson type a response fully, they have some kind of AI machine learning system that allows them to pre-compose messages so the customer support person doesn't have to write the full message. And the way it's pre-composed, they make sure that they know that that message is going to convert better than any other one. So they have a pre-composed message that's supposed to convert well, and then the customer support person can add the information that's required for that specific customer. So that's the kind of things that we're able to do right now with it. But it's not like, you know, the machine that comes out of nowhere and just like and learns and does their own
thing. But in 2027, in 10 years' time, I mean, the state of machine learning that Google is doing or Alphabet is doing right now, you know, there's been some big leaps with machine learning. So what do you think in 2027 the AIs will be like?
Yeah, so we're going from scripted AI to an AI that can learn, meaning that it doesn't need historical data, as you described with like AlphaGo Zero. It didn't need like millions of games of information to know how to play. It would just play and then lose or win. And then because it's a computer, you know, it can play billions of games super quickly and as a result become really good. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, one of the biggest differences. But it's still very early because we're doing that with a game. And, okay, the Go is a complicated game. Much more complicated than chess, or like there's many more outcomes that are, you know, possible. But still, we're not talking about doing anything extremely sophisticated right now. And it's interesting. There's like that video game company called Unity. They basically showed how, like, with that new generation of AI and neural networks, how you can have, they just have a basic game with like a ball that's going on the platform, and the game is the machine is basically learning how to hold the ball straight on that platform essentially, and it takes just 30 seconds for the game to learn how to do that, which is, you know, which is kind of cool. But it's kind of the level at which we are right now in terms of actual AI that learns.
Yeah, I'm still excited. Yeah. I'm really looking forward to my AI assistant. So one thing that is around the learning is translation and voice search. So voice search has kind of gone mainstream in the last year with the Echo and the Google Home things and, you know, Siri and all the thing, Cortana and all that. So people are using their voice for search, and real-time translation is happening with, you know, Skype has a thing. Kickstarter has a whole load of what looked like real-time translation. Now, obviously, you're French, so, I mean, you understand the translation thing a lot more than me, because I'm British, and obviously British people are terrible at languages. but what do you think about the translation possibilities in the next 10 years for reading in other languages?
Yeah, no, it's actually interesting you asking me that question, because, like, when I was raising money for Readzy, one investor who was actually not interested in investing in Readzy, one morning wakes up and says, "Hey, do you have that tool that my dad can use so he can read that book that's in English, but he doesn't read English, he only reads Spanish?" And like, no, dude, I don't have that tool. Like, you know, it doesn't exist. You know, like, either he finds a translation, or he reads it in English. Anyway, and I thought that was quite interesting, because obviously right now there's no on-demand translation service that does an amazing job, or it works for like basic things. Like, there's that company called Unbabel. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard about it. They basically have a machine that does the basic translating, so just voice recognition, and then, you know, translates kind of like word by word. And then they have a community of human beings who are actually going to edit that translation. So you can have people watching the conference on the internet, and then maybe there's going to be a slight delay, but we're going to be able to translate extremely quickly what the person on stage actually said. And that's kind of an interesting, it's kind of a mix of, you know, working with humans and, like, you know, and actually working with the machine. Google, like, I think they recently, like, revamped the translation service for Chinese. But I know it took them, you know, years to actually go from that very basic system to something slightly more sophisticated. And still, I think the technology they have is insanely slow compared to the previous one. I mean, it gives better translation, much better translation, but it's insanely slow. So they actually, so I know they had to like add transitions and stuff, so people don't realize that there's actually, you know, a lot of processing going on to actually translate the sentence. So we're going like great progress. I wish I spoke Chinese to be able to see what Google did with Google Translate, but it's a fairly recent change, and yeah, it's getting super interesting. But translation, like for the literary world, like, you know, translate basic articles, technical stuff, you know, it's been out there for a while, but to translate novels, you're going to need something really, really smart, because, you know, translating is rewriting, you know, like... It's not just translating.
Yeah, which is why I kind of see it as it will be very possible for nonfiction, you know, there's probably ways we could do nonfiction right now. And there's possibly, you know, there's tools you can run novels over to say how the level of the language. And there's obviously a big difference between books that are aimed at a reading age of 14, which apparently is the average reading age in America, versus, you know, a literary fiction novel that wins prizes. Those are very different languages. So I can see it kind of moving on that scale. So nonfiction first, as you say, you can pretty much translate websites and articles right now, which are nonfiction.
Yeah, totally.
So do you see that transition? You know, it's like a phased thing.
Yeah, but you know, like, so I can remember when I saw a video of like, just like scientists in like the 50s, like during the Cold War, basically you had to translate, you know, wanted to know like what the Russians were saying, and they wanted like a machine that would translate very fast from Russian into English. So they started developing that machine that would actually translate things. And it was back in the 50s, you know. So we've been able to translate things almost, you know, on demand for a while. But doing something more literary, when you need to understand like the political, historical, cultural context and everything, we're still a bit far from it. But you know, it's, you know, people were already talking about it in the 50s, or maybe even before, and I'm not aware of it. So it maybe it takes a bit longer than what we would expect.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. The take this to the problem with a 10-year timeline, right? Because you know, I haven't got the dates written down, but the sequencing of our human genome. They had, you know, the project was meant to take however many years, like a long, long, long time. And then Craig Venter went and did it a lot faster than expected. And now the cost is a lot lower and it's a lot faster and they can do it in no time at all. And that gets quicker all the time. But that technology was almost like a step change. It was like yesterday it was going to take another 20 years and then today it only took 2 years. So with 10 years, it's really kind of hard to see what will have a step change. And it feels like the blockchain will be a step change. It will literally just, because it's happening, all the banks are looking at blockchain, right? Because they know they're going to be disintermediated or whatever the word is.
So the banks, it's really funny because, they set up funds to invest, or incubators and funds, to invest and follow startups. And then the CEO wakes up and says, you know, this is all bullshit. And, you know, and then you have headlines in every newspaper. It's really funny.
Yeah, I think they're trying to keep it down from the mainstream while in the background they're building their own stuff on the blockchain.
Yeah, they're often building like private applications.
Exactly. That,
you know, kind of like the opposite of, you know, the whole concept of a blockchain, actually. but also maybe to solve some of the scalability issues that some of those technologies have.
Yeah, and I can see a lot of people who aren't comfortable with it using their established bank blockchain. They'll be like, oh, it's just a new technology my bank is doing, like the mobile app, you know, that's what it is. And other people will use it in a different way. But let's move on to augmented reality and virtual reality, because I actually wrote an article about the VR bookstore back in March 2015. As usual, I'm always very optimistic about timelines, and we're still nowhere near that, and it's not gone mainstream. AR, you know, when people hold up a phone and can see things. So translation, AR translation, you know, you can hold up your app over a sign in Japan and it will tell you the sign in English. So that's a kind of augmented reality. So what do you think of AR and VR? What do you reckon going to happen there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to an event a few months ago about AR and VR. And there was one of the founders of a company called Blipper, which is, they create a bunch of AR and VR technologies. And what the guy did is like he took his phone out of his pocket and he pointed it at someone in the room. And he had an idea that person was relatively, not, I wouldn't say famous, but, you know, like a guy with like a certain following on the internet, someone you would want to get information about. He pointed it at that person, and then the phone detected who it was and started to give information about that very person. And they already have a significant database of like faces, and they're able to do face recognition super fast, and then bring up like get interesting results about that person. So it's interesting, but it's like the reaction of the audience when he did that was really weird, because most people were like, okay, I'm not sure I want people to be able to
example.
But so it, it, um, But what I find really interesting is like the application of VR for the real world. Not just VR for the sake of VR, but VR for applications in the real world. So for instance, I saw that video recently, for healthcare and like stuff. So right now you have docked the Western world, but not necessarily the same access to healthcare in different and other parts of the world. And you can think that with VR, we're going to be able to do surgery remotely. Let's say you just have the right tools, the right machine somewhere on the planet. You just need a doctor based wherever in London, Paris, San Francisco, wherever. And they can do surgery on someone who is on the other side of the planet. Mm. They just need the right internet connection, essentially. And also just to train surgeons, for instance, there's stuff, that you don't, you don't do surgery on very often. So how do you train doctors? Well, you can have those new tools. We're going to need new devices, basically, to experience all those new things. But you can have those new tools that, you have some feedback whenever you hit something, and then you know whether you can keep going or not. And that's going to be really interesting. I saw there's a company called Glitchers. They have, I don't know if you saw, they have an app that was downloaded like maybe 3 million times, and that helped advanced dementia research, essentially. Mm. So they make people in a special environment and they look at how they react. And since it's a very immersive experience, they're able to like get information about who has dementia or who doesn't, essentially. So it's a kind of applications that I find extremely interesting. I haven't seen, I have to say, like things are this interesting in the book space, essentially. Mm. But hopefully that will come. But that often comes with like interesting devices, because right now if everybody has to put their phone in front of their face, yeah, or whatever headset, I'm not sure that VR is going to be that interesting. Right now there's probably more interesting applications for AR in general than VR, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I see the VR thing as more like, there's online summits at the moment or online training courses like Reezy have, where you decide I'm going to sit down right now and I'm going to go and do this course online. And I kind of see that more like, okay, I'm going to go and attend a summit in VR, and we would be doing, I see myself doing a podcast in VR, we would be in an environment instead of Skype that people could actually come and, see it live, or instead of doing, summits on a flat screen, you would be able to do it and teach. So I see the application is more around teaching and training and learning than, reading a book necessarily. And like you said, the medical technology, people learning how to operate. And I've seen videos of, electronic stuff, where people wear an AR visor and they can actually see it's telling them where to put the thing. And so it's kind of the training aspect, I think, is interesting. And also the marketing, because I could walk around London recording where I am. And then if you were in London, you could bring up your AR thing and follow me around, virtually kind of that way.
Yeah. There's also like really interesting applications for designers. Because like right now you're moving a model on a 2D, 2D screen, when you could actually be moving around your object and like changing it as you move around, like, which is like just a totally different experience.
Which is very cool. And I think this is really important, because I see authors need to think about applications for their books that go beyond the book. So that's almost like a gaming experience, or a solve this murder mystery. You actually get to go into and find the objects and stuff like that. Kind of thing, I think, will become more happening.
Yeah, it's a very interesting change. Like, instead of us building weird interfaces to manipulate things, we're actually going to manipulate the end product directly. It's a bit like on the phone, like, when Apple introduced that kind of like natural scrolling, you would be moving the content instead of moving the page. So instead of scrolling, so it changed the way people scroll on the page. And it felt very weird to a lot of people. But in the end, what Apple did is like they made us move the content. We were directly touching with our fingers the content, instead of having kind of a quirky interface where we'd like, with a mouse, we would be moving the scrolling bar on the side. And it's kind of the same. It's like an even more advanced change in terms of user interface. It's really interesting.
Mm. Oh, goodness. There's still so much we could talk about. And I know we're pretty much out of time. But I did want to, the thing that I think is more urgent in terms of the thing that will probably happen soon or is happening is by 2025, it's expected that 8 billion people will be on the internet. Now, in the leapfrog countries, so sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, where they're not going to have laptops or desktops, they're going straight to mobile economies with digital currency. So, and I'm excited about that because these are where our customers can be right now, but also more customers like the middle classes in India or Nigeria, or, you know, there are lots of countries in the world who have not gone digital yet in terms of their reading. So are you thinking about that? Are you excited about global and digital? Do you think that's going to happen, you know, sooner?
Yeah. It's Oh, sooner? I don't know. Like 8 billion people on the internet. What do we have right now? Two or three?
Yeah, it's three or four. Yeah.
In the next 8 years, more than 5 billion more on the internet. I don't know. It sounds reasonable. But in terms of opportunities, it's obviously more customers. And maybe with like things like blockchain, we can have like a more global, you know, competitive landscape. Because right now you do have like a Chinese market and a Russian market and a kind of a more Western market, but they don't really work with each other that much. When you go to China, you're on your computer and you're like, what can I do really that I'm used to, you know, to be doing? so it's a very weird feeling. So even though it's the internet, it's still not that decentralized and not everybody's got access to everything. So it's going to be not just more customers, but a lot more competition, which is interesting.
Yes, but it's interesting. So on the competition aspect, because of course, Readsy is connecting writers with professionals, and I write nonfiction for authors. So, and I've been telling writers this. So if you write fiction, you should also be writing how-to nonfiction about how you write fiction, because the number of new writers coming online is also
huge. Yeah.
Exponential. So and the self-help environment is only getting bigger, right? With self-driving cars, the end of jobs, aging boomers, you know, all these things that we haven't even talked about will bring more people into the writing environment. So,
above all, people will have a lot more time.
Exactly. More time. Because
right now we still work jobs. Like, you know, most people have a job, but in the future, people might not need a job. So we'll find out. But, you know, like, I have a friend of mine who was telling me that in Japan, they started to educate the population to the idea that they might not have a job. Like, the kids might not have a job in the future. And that's fine.
Exactly.
I don't know whether it's going to happen or whether it's going to be totally different. But we can think that maybe in the future people won't have a job, and maybe the unemployment rate will be like totally irrelevant because, you know, everybody won't be making money without necessarily having to work. So then we have to do something else. What do we do?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, universal credit and these sort of big shifts are probably the things that will shape the next 10 years that are coming. But then just from your perspective, as someone who is, you know, a lot younger than me, and many people listening hear the end of jobs or people won't have a job and they are very scared. So as, you know, someone who is growing up, or no, you are grown up, obviously, but, you know, who's someone who is much more happy with a lot of this technology, what are you excited about? Like, are you optimistic about the next 10 years?
Yeah. You know, I'm happy and not happy. I don't have a Facebook account.
Mm.
You know, so like I'm happy and totally aware of like all the bad things that comes with technology. And for me, like Facebook is one of the worst things on the internet. But I still love technology. You know, I'm the guy who's going to start an account for like the next social network the day it's out. And then maybe if I see that there's something wrong with it, I'll just stop. In a situation where, you know, we are kind of like our worst enemy and like, you know, we can destroy ourselves if we want to.
But you've got to be positive. Like what do you see for the next 10 years of Readsy, for example? You know, you've got a company, you know, what do you see coming?
So I'm sorry, I'm not responding, but I never look at anything like from a 10 years perspective. I mean, like, I like to do it as kind of an exercise, but for the company itself, I look at it like, you know, what's going to happen in 18 months max. And when you raise money from investors, most of them ask you, like, you know, you raise money for 18 months most of the time. So you don't want to be raising every year, but every year and a half, you go out and raise money. Not everyone. We're not doing that right now at Readzy, but a lot of startups actually do that. So I don't really look at it, you know, over like a 10-year period, but more like, you know, a couple of years. And right now we have a lot of things to grow. And we are quite focused on a problem, trying to maybe release a new product for that. So it's kind of like the our current focus. But what I'll be or what Readzy will be in 10 years, I have no idea. And I'm fine with that. I'm totally fine with that. But, you know, like the future is a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, it's whatever you want it to be. So if we decided to destroy ourselves, we'll destroy ourselves. Or if we decided to colonize, you know, to go on Mars and just live there, then, you know, we'll make that happen. But in the end, it's not that interesting. We got cars, you know, amazing technology. And then we started, you know, crashing ourselves into whatever. Then we added seat belts, and then we added airbags, and then we added traffic lights. So we keep going, you know, we keep adding more stuff and adding more complexity to our lives. But in the end, it's not necessarily like what matters. So it's kind of like technology can be an enabler, but it's not the ultimate goal, essentially.
And that's good. That kind of circles back, because we started off talking about technology as an enabler. And that's basically what we should be doing going forward, right? As authors and entrepreneurs, we will use technology as an enabler and move forward.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So tell people where they can find you and Readzy online.
Yeah. So as I said, I'm not on Facebook, but you can find me on Twitter. So Emmanuel Nataf. And if you want to email me, I'm emmanuel@readzy.com. So I'm guessing it will be somewhere in the notes.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Emmanuel. That was great.
Thanks a lot, Jen. Thank you very much.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Emmanuel Nataf today, and check out Readzy for vetted professional editors, cover designers, marketers, and lots of great tools. And I recommend using Readzy for the fact that those professionals are vetted and they do check them all. And you can listen to the interview with Ricardo Fayette, also co-founder of Readzy, also French, that you can listen to a couple of months ago now. I can never remember when I talked to people, but really great. And I am an affiliate of Readzy. So if you would like to check them out and you'd like to support the show in other ways, go to thecreativepen.com/Readzy, R-E-E-D-S-Y. So next week, I'll be talking to the two Marks from the Bestseller Experiment podcast. If you haven't listened to their show, they basically announced that they would write a bestseller in a year. And then they interviewed a load of successful authors and, you know, marketing people and publishing people and very, very well connected pair of guys. One of the Marks actually works in a publishing house. So they had lots of connections, and they interviewed successful traditionally published authors and successful indies, including me and Mark Dawson and a whole load of other people. So you'll get some great tips, and in order to learn everything they could. And I think the other thing I would say is, because they understand publishing, and one of the other Mark was a musician, so they understand a lot of the indie stuff. But many of the questions they asked over the year are great if you are just starting out. So next week, they're going to talk about how it went. You know, spoiler, it did become a bestseller. So how did they do that? And it's really interesting to get some reflections on what they learned over the year and what they're going to do next. So tune in next week. Happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.